From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, a renegade Libyan general suspends parliament.
We have this self-proclaimed liberator, a former general, who is coming in with his own mercenary army and trying to take control of things himself.
India awaits change as a new leader takes over. The South Korean president dismantles the Coast Guard after the ferry tragedy. A new blog focusing on energy and the planet. And is there a right to be forgotten? It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. Militiamen loyal to a retired Libyan general say they have suspended parliament after launching an attack against the legislative body. Renegade forces commanded by former general Khalifa Haftar on Sunday stormed the parliament building in Tripoli, firing weapons and ransacking lawmakers' offices. Dark smoke could be seen billowing into the air from the building. Unconfirmed reports say two people were killed and about 50 others wounded in the violence. Early today, Libya's interim government condemned the attack. Stephen Junis is chairman of Middle East Studies at the University of San Francisco. He tells VOA's Victor Beatty things seem to be spinning out of control in Libya 3 years after the ouster of longtime dictator Muammar Gaddafi.
And there was hope, of course, when a moderate government was popularly elected after the overthrow of the long-reigning dictator. But unfortunately, we've seen a situation where there are over 200,000 men under arms and militia that are not accountable to any central authority in a country of less than 6 million, and many of which are hardline Islamists who not only are throwing their weight around militarily, but trying to impose very strict interpretations of Islamic law in ways that most Libyans don't feel good about. And as a result, we have this self-proclaimed liberator, a former general, who is coming in with his own mercenary army and trying to take control of things himself. Unlike Tunisia and Egypt, where despite autocratic rule, a civil society was able to emerge and thus lay the foundations for at least some democratic institutions, the situation in Libya, being a rentier state, being one that was dependent on the sale of oil and the totalitarian style of leadership of Gaddafi, has led to a very weak civil society. So there were some popular democratic institutions emerged in the course of the uprising in 2011. They really don't have much foundation with which to build a strong democracy, and despite the desires of the majority of Libyans to have that. And as a result, the vacuum has been filled by these armed groups.
Zunis says although the international community has tried to develop democratic institutions in Libya, there is a long-time resistance to outsiders dating back to Italy's control of the country during part of the first half of the 20th century. The United Nations warns that an alarming deterioration in the human rights situation in eastern Ukraine is threatening to tear the country apart. A report by the UN Human Rights Office documents unlawful activities of armed groups in the east and highlights emerging problems in Crimea since Russia annexed it in March. Gianni Magazzini is head of the European branch of the Office of the UN High Commissioner for Refugees. He says the apparent breakdown of law and order in eastern Ukraine is of great concern.
He points to evidence of lack of law and order in a number of very critical human rights violations and concern in the East, especially as a result of the presence, the action, the direct influence through the guns, but also indirectly through intimidation and threat on journalists, on ordinary people, when it comes to the ability for anyone to express oneself. Some self-proclaimed mayors have also banned some political parties.
The report finds differences between Russian law and Ukrainian law are creating difficulties for Crimean residents. The report also notes that 7,200 people from Crimea, mainly Tatars, have left the peninsula and are displaced in other parts of Ukraine. Magazzini tells VOA the UN is concerned about hate speech and other forms of harassment and intimidation being leveled at the Tatars. He noted that Sunday was the 70th anniversary of the mass deportation of Tatars from Crimea by the government of Soviet dictator Joseph Stalin.
We're very conscious of what they've gone through and the potential additional discrimination and the violations of their rights that may result from the issue of citizenship or statelessness. I think that is not an issue if they choose to leave, but what is the impact vis-a-vis their land, vis-a-vis their rights, vis-a-vis their work, vis-a-vis their family? For those who have stayed behind, those are critical issues that we would like to be able to monitor.
Weighing in on the issues, UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Navi Pillay is urging all Ukrainian political leaders to stop inflaming the situation in the country and to allow the May 25th election to go ahead in a free and transparent manner. The world's largest democracy this week experiences a transition of government. After a total defeat for the Congress Party in elections with a record high turnout of more than 553 million voters, the soft-spoken Sikh 81-year-old Manmohan Singh gives way to the forthright 63-year-old Hindu nationalist Narendra Modi of the Bharatiya Janata Party. VOA correspondent Steve Herman in New Delhi looks at Mr. Modi's leadership style and governing priorities as he takes charge of the world's second most populous country.
India's parliamentary election saw Gujarat's chief minister Narendra Modi's BJP crushing the liberal and secular Congress Party, which was not able to keep India economically apace of neighbor China. Over a decade while the Congress was in power, the economy created just one-tenth of the jobs necessary to keep pace with its growing population. The big question, can the next leader improve on that record? Mr. Modi is known for pro-business policies and has pledged support for two long elusive goals, a corruption-free government and universal secondary education, but he is criticized as an autocrat. Mr. Modi's party comes into office with enormous political power, able to pass laws without any coalition partners, and with the Congress Party severely crippled. That has elements of civil society wary. Siddharth Varadarajan, senior fellow at the Center for Public Affairs and Critical Theory, says they should be especially vigilant.
I cannot recall a prime minister who has been quite so polarizing a figure and who brings to power as much divisive baggage as Mr. Modi brings.
Critics contend that during Mr. Modi's dozen years as chief minister in Gujarat, his state waged a systematic campaign against justice for Muslims and other minorities. Varadarajan says India cannot have inequalities and social tension while hoping to maintain sustained growth.
One troubling feature of the campaign Mr. Modi ran was that he was often counterposing his promises of growth with secularism and saying, do you want growth or do you want secularism? Which I think is really a very false choice to offer the electorate because a country like India needs both.
As India's 17th prime minister, the staunch Hindu nationalist will have to reach beyond his base and modify his style, says economist Parth Shah, who runs the Center for Civil Society think tank dedicated to India's social challenges.
I do think that Mr. Modi is smart enough to know that you can run a small state in a particular fashion. You cannot run a 1.2 billion people large country with so many diverse interests and so many different strong personalities at the state level in the way that you could run a single state.
Observer Research Foundation distinguished fellow Manoj Joshi says the new prime minister, when it comes to domestic and foreign policy, will find it difficult to deviate from the government's primary mandate that goes back to India's independence in 1947.
More than anything else, and above everything else, beyond the foreign policy disputes, entanglements, etc., is this huge compulsion to try and pull up people from poverty.
Mr. Modi, who comes from humble caste and class, in his youth worked in tea stalls. Now his supporters among the masses, who gave him a landslide victory, are hoping he can deliver on his promise to serve them their tall order for achieving upward mobility. Steve Herman, VOA News, New Delhi.
South Korea's president has announced plans to dismantle the nation's Coast Guard after a poor rescue response to the ferry disaster last month that killed more than 300 people. Most of the victims were teenagers, and authorities are still trying to recover 18 bodies believed trapped aboard the capsized sunken ship. VOA's Daniel Scharf reports from Seoul.
President Park Geun-hye Monday said South Korea's Coast Guard was insufficiently trained for rescue work when the Sewol passenger ferry sank on April 16th with 476 people on board. In a live speech on national television, Ms. Park said with the Coast Guard's current structural problems, another big accident might not be prevented. Therefore, the president said, the Coast Guard would be dismantled.
앞으로 수사 정보 기능은 경찰청으로 넘기고
She says the government will move to strengthen the professionalism of and responsibility for coastal safety. Ms. Park says the government will transfer the investigation and intelligence function of the Coast Guard to the National Police Agency and the rescue and security function to a newly created Ministry of National Safety. Most of those who died when the five-story ferry sank off Korea's southwestern coast were high school students on a field trip. Authorities were widely criticized for giving wrong information on the number of passengers and casualties, as well as a slow rescue response. Education authorities initially told parents the students survived the sinking, but reversed their comments within hours as the scale of the tragedy unfolded. Distraught and frantic relatives of passengers rushed to Jindo Island to watch rescue efforts. About 170 passengers survived, but all were rescued on the first day. Hopes for survivors turned to anger and grief as rescue divers struggled for days against rough seas to reach those trapped in the sunken ferry. The Coast Guard chief and Prime Minister Chung Hong-won were in charge of the rescue operation. Mr. Chung last month offered his resignation over the disaster. A teary-eyed President Park on Monday issued another apology, echoing one made last week to parents of victims. She says as president, she is responsible for lives and safety and offers a heartfelt apology for the pain people have suffered. She says the ultimate responsibility for failing to respond properly to this accident lies with her. But most of the blame is being directed at the ferry's captain, crew, and owners, the family that owns the ship under Patriarch Yoo Byung-un. South Korean media report the 6,800-ton ferry was carrying three times as much cargo as allowed under safety rules and made a sharp turn just before it began to sink. The captain and three crew members are facing manslaughter charges for telling passengers to stay below in their cabins while they themselves were among the first to abandon ship. The Yoo family is believed to be in hiding and refuses to appear for questioning. The family heads a Christian religious sect that since last week is blocking police from searching its headquarters. The family's company, Chonghae Jin Marine, is suspected of corruption and tax evasion. Some people have also blamed South Korea's culture of deferring to seniority, which has been blamed for past disasters such as airline crashes, for the high death toll in the ferry accident. But political analyst Hwang Tae-soon at Seoul's Wisdom Center think tank says passengers were simply listening to those who were supposed to know best. He says it was not just the teenagers, but also the adults who followed the directions of the captain and crew members who were the professional experts on the ship. It is a totally separate matter, he says, from the culture of deferring to adults and authority. Daniel Scherf, VOA News, Seoul.
Chinese workers by the thousands are being evacuated by boat and plane from Vietnam following anti-China rioting last week that left two people dead and more than 140 injured. The violence, rare in communist-run Vietnam, erupted after the state-run China Energy Company towed a deep-water oil rig to waters near the Paracel Islands, claimed to be in Vietnam's exclusive economic zone. Malcolm Cook, a senior fellow at the Institute for Southeast Asian Studies in Singapore, tells VOA's Victor Beatty the unrest is aimed not just at the Chinese, but also the Vietnamese government, which has historically close ties to Beijing.
Certainly, there has long been. So if you're the Vietnamese president, certainly China's actions put you in a very bad position. Plus, even though it's not ever mentioned in the state media and so forth, there is growing anger when China does these types of actions that there are these very close ties. So Vietnam sent their deputy foreign minister to Beijing to try to manage the relationships. And all authoritarian states, including China, which is coming up to the 25th anniversary of Tiananmen Square, are always worried about letting protest focused on a foreign country kind of spiral into protest focused more on domestic issues.
Well, the state-run China Daily today said anti-Chinese rioting in Vietnam has raised doubts about Vietnam's commitment to foreign investment.
The fact that, as I said, without a doubt, that's a very sore point for the government now because of hundreds of factories, both factories owned by Chinese businesses, mostly by Taiwanese businesses and Koreans, were targeted and many of them were destroyed and hundreds of people had to be. So Vietnam's recent economic success is being built on attracting particularly Taiwanese and Korean investment, and these riots have added political risk to that. I don't think it'll lead to a huge outflow of investment from Vietnam, but it may slow down in the short term new inflows.
Do you suggest that China is reaping what it has sown in with regard to its recent aggressive moves in the South China Sea?
Oh, without a doubt, definitely. At the same time that they have created this new kind of diplomatic and incident with Vietnam, a country that had long been seen to have relatively cooperative, if tense, relations with China. They're doing this at the same time as the dispute with the Philippines over another part of the South China Sea is escalating, and of course their dispute with Japan in the East China Sea is also at probably a very high level of concern. So either the Chinese government isn't aware of what its actions in these three areas are likely to trigger the response, or they don't care.
Cook does not foresee China removing its oil rig at the center of the dispute. It says it is an exploratory operation that will likely remain in place until its purpose is complete in mid-August. Removing it now, he says, would be taken at home to mean buckling to international pressure. However, Cook suggests Beijing might be more circumspect in the future about taking actions in the region.
China is a fascinating country
with interesting people doing amazing things.
Every Friday, we focus attention on some of our favorite things coming out of China during the previous week.
It may be political, it may be cultural.
It may simply be a curiosity that caught our attention.
But we'll find stories sure to be of interest.
And then, of course, we'll add our own American perspectives as well.
I'm Sarah Williams.
I'm Jim Stevenson.
Join us for China Focus every Friday at 12 hours Universal Time on VOA Radio.
And anytime on the web at voanews.com and on Facebook VOA Asia.
The Washington-based think tank Brookings Institution is focusing attention on the condition of Earth by launching a new online blog. Planet Policy bills itself as the intersection of energy and climate policy. Bill Antholis is a senior fellow at Brookings Institution who writes on climate issues.
We at Brookings have been looking at energy and climate issues for many years, and in the 12-year Strobe has been president, and the 10 years that I've been managing director, climate and energy has been one of the institutional priorities that cuts across Brookings. And we've done a lot of work on it over the years, but we decided that given a whole number of things, including the growing scientific evidence about the current day impacts of climate change, as well as a series of both domestic and international policy developments, we thought that we should have a dedicated, regularly traveled space bringing together the breadth and depth of our research.
So you're talking about global warming, but what are the programs that have brought you to this point?
Well, we have five research programs at Brookings, going from the local to the national to the global, economic, and political. So we have a foreign policy program, a global economy program, economic studies, governance studies, and metropolitan studies, looking at state and metropolitan regions in the United States and increasingly around the world. And all five of those programs has had consistent programming on energy and climate change issues. And we decided to bring them all together under one cyber roof through the Planet Policy blog.
What do you hope this will do for the public, for your readers?
Well, a couple different things. One, start a conversation, get input from a number of different participants. It's going to be a blog that's open to outside contributors. We will certainly edit it and curate it, but we're keen to reach out to others and bring them into the conversation and demonstrate the range and breadth of this issue. I think Richard Gephardt once said that had a great line about climate change, that the effort to address climate change is the most complex political transaction in the history of mankind. And what he meant by that was that climate is an issue that covers our energy is a sector of our economy, about one-sixth of the economy, about the size of the healthcare part of our economy. We all saw how complex it was to do major comprehensive healthcare reform. So we would have to do that in the United States on climate change, but we would then have to do that in the other 192 or 194, depending on what you count, 190 some odd countries in the world if we're going to address this global challenge. And we're going to have to synchronize it and do it in a way that not only happens roughly at the same time, but responds to the very different needs, aspirations, levels of development, and uses of energy in the rest of the world. So the complexity of that political undertaking is something that we want to use this blog to demonstrate. So we'll have people blogging about local metropolitan approaches to climate change and the global negotiations and hopefully a little bit of everything in between.
Is this something open to just the experts, or can anybody participate?
When you say the word expert, expert has a narrowing effect. I think what we want are informed citizens who bring a contribution from different sides of the issue. So we'll be looking at technical experts on energy systems. We'll be looking at people who work on the politics of climate change. We'll be looking at people who work on the broad economic effects and also on the impacts of climate change. You know, as this most recent scientific assessment indicates, we are already seeing dramatic impacts. And one of the contributors is somebody who has just joined Brookings in Nevada. She is the head of the Las Vegas, or was for 30 years, the head of the Las Vegas Valley Water Authority. And she has been dealing day-to-day with the front line of climate change, which is the water-stressed environment that is the American West broadly, and the Colorado River in particular. So it's that range of expertise that we'll be drawing into the blog.
And how can somebody get to your site?
If you just go on to Google or Bing or any other of your favorite web engines and simply type in Planet Policy, it should take you to the link to get you to our site.
Bill Anthalis, Managing Director and a Senior Fellow at Brookings Institution. The so-called right to be forgotten is being debated after the European Court of Justice ruled that the internet search engine Google must sometimes, on request, remove links to articles containing personal information. As VOA's Kent Klein reports, it's a debate about which is more important, the right to privacy or the freedom of information.
Many people have something in their past that they would like to remove from the internet, says Glenn Gabe, president of G Squared Interactive, which provides digital marketing services to executives and celebrities. He spoke via Skype.
They went to prison, right? And maybe 10 years ago, everything happened, and everything's still showing up in Google on page one, even though that they paid their dues.
At the Electronic Privacy Information Center, Executive Director Mark Rotenberg agrees with the European Court that privacy is a basic right.
You have to consider the ability of individuals to control the dissemination of information about themselves. That is, in many respects, the core of free expression, how we choose to express ourselves or not to say things or do things. That's, you know, what makes us human.
A number of U.S. privacy advocates disagree with the European Court's Google ruling. It's likely to limit the freedom of information, says Jules Polonetsky, executive director of the Future of Privacy Forum.
So if someone can tell search engines or news aggregators or maybe bloggers, that information tells us about some individual, that individual doesn't want to be found, you need to take it down, the effects really could be dramatic. It breaks the internet.
The European Court ordered Google to delete links containing personal information about a Spanish lawyer's 1998 tax problems at his request, because the information was no longer relevant. The right to a free press is specifically mentioned in the U.S. Constitution, while the right to privacy is merely implied. Jules Polonetsky says access to public information must be protected.
So it's a real blow to transparency if legal public information can be obscured simply because somebody decides that it's information they'd rather not be available.
But Mark Rotenberg says the European judges did a good job of balancing privacy with press freedom.
And what the European Court of Justice has done with this decision is to say, in effect, you know, search is an important service, but it has to be done in a way that protects privacy.
The ruling will be costly for Google and other search engines in Europe, but is not expected to immediately affect their U.S. operations. Kent Klein, VOA News, Washington.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yockey in Washington.
This is Today in History. On May 19th, 1643, representatives of four colonies, Massachusetts, New Haven, Plymouth, and Connecticut, met in Boston to sign the New England Confederation, primarily a military alliance to defend against attacks by Indian tribes. On this day in 1795, American financier and philanthropist Johns Hopkins was born. His legacy includes the world-famous Johns Hopkins University and Hospital in Baltimore, Maryland. In 1864, American novelist Nathaniel Hawthorne died. He was known for his tales of colonial life in such classics as The Scarlet Letter and The House of the Seven Gables. In 1890, Vietnamese nationalist leader Ho Chi Minh was born. He helped found the communist-dominated independence movement called the Viet Minh. Ho fought against Japanese occupation, French colonial rule, and later a U.S.-backed regime in South Vietnam. He died in 1969 before he could see his forces gain victory and unite Vietnam. In 1919, Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, founder of modern Turkey, arrived in Samsun, Anatolia, an event seen as the start of the four-year Turkish War for Independence. In 1935, British officer Thomas Edward Lawrence, better known worldwide as Lawrence of Arabia, died following a motorcycle accident. Lawrence acted as liaison with the Arabs during several conflicts in the Middle East. His exploits gained him international fame. On May 19, 1994, Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis, wife of the assassinated President John F. Kennedy, later married to Greek shipping tycoon Aristotle Onassis, died of cancer. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States remains firmly committed to a stable, secure, and prosperous Pakistan. After some difficult years, said Deputy Secretary of State William Burns on his recent visit to Pakistan, the U.S.-Pakistan relationship is on a positive trajectory, a trajectory we hope to not only maintain, but accelerate. Pakistan's leadership has undergone courageous economic reforms and concrete steps to expand regional economic linkages. The United States has been doing its part to be as helpful as possible. This includes a number of strategic investments that have contributed to Pakistan's economic growth, from funding the construction and rehabilitation of nearly 900 kilometers of roads to nearly $900 million in energy sector assistance, which will add 1,400 megawatts to Pakistan's power grid by the end of 2014. As Pakistan continues to act on its International Monetary Fund commitments, the U.S. will look to do even more. Indeed, both governments recently met in Washington to discuss joint plans to increase trade and investment over the next 5 years. Militancy continues to threaten Pakistan's revival. Few countries have paid a heavier price than Pakistan in the fight against extremism. The U.S. supports Pakistani Prime Minister Sharif's efforts to reestablish authority over all Pakistani territory in whatever way Pakistan deems appropriate, and especially urges him to sustain pressure on militant groups, deny them a safe haven, and prevent cross-border attacks. Countering cross-border militants and shutting down safe havens is critical not only for Pakistan's long-term peace and prosperity, but also for positive relations between Pakistan and all its neighbors, including Afghanistan. The U.S. appreciates Pakistan's efforts to further Afghan-led reconciliation. The U.S. hopes to sign a bilateral security agreement later this year that will enable the U.S. to train, advise, and assist Afghan forces and go after the remnants of core al-Qaeda. This is deeply in our interest, said Deputy Secretary Burns, and in the interest of Afghanistan, Pakistan, and the rest of South and Central Asia. This is a moment of opportunity for the U.S.-Pakistan relationship. We share a deep stake in continuing to strengthen the foundations of our partnership, said Deputy Secretary Burns. And we share a deep commitment to putting that partnership to work to realize our shared vision of a more peaceful and prosperous Pakistan and a more peaceful and prosperous South Asia.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.